Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacy Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, news and views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Hi there, my name is Monica Kenny. Welcome to the 1 year anniversary of the Paleo View, episode 52. Today we will be sharing the top moments of the Paleo View in the last year with feedback from all of you awesome listeners on what episodes you like the best and what resonated with you most. So hopefully you enjoy. I am here to guide this show so that Stacy and Sarah can have a little bit of breathing room for a week and hopefully get a little time off to pursue some of the other projects that they're working on. So who am I? I am the assistant to the Paleo Parents. I've been working with them for almost half a year now, which is really hard to believe. I was a fan of their site for a very long time and started listening to this show right from the time it was created. And at the time I was a new mom with a newborn at home. And this show for me was the pat on the back that I needed to go against what conventional wisdom and conventional doctors were telling me to do with my newborn son. So this show meant a great deal to me when I really first started listening to it, especially in those first couple episodes where Sarah and Stacy gave a lot of information now what kids really need from nutrition and where they're going to get their nutrients and why not to stress out about calcium supplements and all these other things that pediatricians and moms fill your head with. So for me personally, this show has been a huge source of support for parenting. And I know for many of the listeners, you all feel much of the same. So first up, to kick off this show, we're going to go ahead and start, as we always do, with some science with Sarah. The first one, by popular request, that we're going to be sharing is an overview on the autoimmune protocol. This was from episode 2, and it's where Sarah hits on some of the major points about the autoimmune protocol.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Sarah, I know we've touched on it earlier, but can you describe what an autoimmune protocol is, and then what foods you would recommend eating more of since we're taking so many foods out?
Yeah, I think that that's a really important place to start. It's exactly what the autoimmune protocol is, because I think we've touched on various aspects of it. But the idea behind the autoimmune protocol is to pull out foods that are sort of gray area foods. They've got something that are potentially problematic for sensitive individuals, and they're the foods that you tend to see food sensitivities and food allergies to more commonly. With individuals with autoimmune disease, we tend to be hypersensitive to many of these, if not all of them. So the foods that are further restricted on the autoimmune protocol, so this is in addition to a standard paleo diet. So we don't eat eggs. We don't eat vegetables from the nightshade family. So that's tomatoes, eggplants, sweet and hot peppers, and any spices that are derived from peppers, which includes chilies. Curry usually has chili in it, and paprika. Black pepper actually is not a nightshade, although it's still a seed, which I'm about to talk about, and worthy of some caution. The next big group of foods that are restricted on the Paleo Diet Autoimmune Protocol are all nuts and seeds. And that includes some things that we tend to allow ourselves to have, which are things like coffee and chocolate, at least initially. Then there's no alcohol. And that, I know, so sad. But really, we're talking about actual alcohol. So it is okay to cook with some wine or some hard liquor that's at least sort of a gluten-free, you know, not something that's derived from wheat.
That does not mean that you get to drink the rest of the bottle.
You don't get to drink the rest of the bottle anymore, but you can still make your stew with your, you know, glug, 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 glug of red wine. So another really important thing to avoid when you're on the autoimmune protocol is non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs. Those are drugs like Advil and aspirin and naproxen. And a lot of women especially have issues with birth control contributing to autoimmune disease. Now, that's something that I always say, like, you need to do a cost-benefit analysis and figure out what your priorities are, if there's alternatives that you can use, or if this is like a non-starter, then leave your birth control in for now and deal with everything else. But just remember that that could be a contributor if you're not healing the way you want to when you remove everything else. And then I guess the last sort of group of foods that is problematic for a lot of people, but not everybody, is starchy vegetables. That comes down to the fact that many people, potentially most, although that hasn't systematically been studied, people who have an autoimmune disease also have gut dysbiosis. So they have either the wrong kind of bacteria growing in their gut, or they're growing in the wrong place, or they're growing in the wrong quantities, or combination of all those things. And so that takes elements of the GAPS diet or the SCD diet, which I'll talk about more in a second, and sort of avoids complex sugars that take longer to digest, so they have a higher likelihood of still being intact when they hit those bacteria and help feed them and propel this either small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or other form of gut dysbiosis, which if you have that, that hinders healing. So the reason why all of these things are excluded is because they all have the potential to irritate the gut and propel inflammation. For normal, healthy people, they tend not to be a problem. There's some really good evidence that people with autoimmune disease just have these really hyperactive immune systems and these very inflamed guts that are really hard to heal. So you really need to take these foods out so that you can heal completely. When we talk about how long you need to take them out, a lot of books say take them out for a month and then start reintroducing. My general recommendation, because this is a very individual thing, there are, you know, over 100 different autoimmune diseases. And you, within each disease, there's a spectrum in how bad, you know, how advanced the disease might be, is to follow the protocol until you see your symptoms improving. Ideally, you would follow the protocol until your disease was in full remission, and then you would start playing with adding things back in, because what you're looking for is that your body has healed. It can take a long time for your gut to heal. I mean, anywhere from a couple of weeks to 6 months, depending on how inflamed it is now. And then once things stop leaking across the gut, it can still take up to 6 months to turn the autoimmunity antibody production off. So it can be a really, I mean, this is why you know, I always try to say, be patient, hang in there a little bit longer. It can be a very slow going process. So I guess the other part of the question is what to eat more of, because there are healing foods that we can incorporate into our diet that can help speed healing and make us healthier. So I think it's really important to eat a lot of fish, especially oily cold water fish, because of its high omega-3 content. It's high in iodine and selenium and vitamin D. I think it's really important to eat lots of grass-fed beef. Again, it has a good omega-3 to omega-6 ratio, but it also has conjugated linoleic acid in it, which is a natural trans fat, but it's a very healing anti-inflammatory fat.
So can I get CLA from my pastured pig and my grass-fed lamb as well?
Now, I don't actually know the answer about pig, but I do know that the answer is yes for pastured lamb or for grass-fed lamb. Pastured pig's a bit funny because they're usually supplemented with all kinds of things. So their fat profile still isn't as good or as reliable, because different farmers will feed their, supplement their pigs' diets with different things. So it would really depend on the farmer. So I don't know the answer to pig, and I can look it up maybe for the show notes.
I'm just saying, don't take my bacon.
No, have your bacon. I'm talking foods to increase in your diet. I never said take away bacon.
I know.
I'm not giving you license to eat a pound of it every day. Sorry.
We take everything else out. I will tell you, I've definitely increased my bacon eating and I'm totally fine, but I do get we order, half pigs. And so we have a lot of pork and it comes from a very legit source, but.
So I think just, sort of a word of caution, because pastured pigs diets are always supplemented, and you really have to talk to your farmer and find out what they're being given. Corn is very common. And I wouldn't worry about that as much as I would worry about like pigs being fed things like soy or wheat. Like that to me just, makes me feel uneasy. But like I know for myself that I tend to have really strong digestive distress when I eat non-pastured, bacon. And if I eat pastured bacon, I'm like totally fine and feel great and enjoy it. And it's just so,
You again, you were talking about
lots of
CLA being wonderful. And it
lots of grass-fed meat. It's also, you know, really important to get enough protein, because you need those proteins to heal. It's really important to eat organ meat. And I know that organ meat can be uncomfortable for a lot of people. I've posted some recipes on my site for ways to hide it. And I know you have too, for ways to hide it in foods. The only organ meats that I really eat are liver and heart, because I can't stand the taste of kidneys.
Heart is so easy.
I love heart. Heart is like, I would rather eat heart than muscle meat.
I don't know if you've been brave enough to do this yet. Tongue is amazingly delicious too.
I used to have tongue all the time when I was a kid, and yet I haven't bought it. My farmer's always been out when I've asked.
P.S. Organ meat is cheap. So
that's the other great thing. It is such a cheap meat. I eat organ meat every day. I suggest for the autoimmune protocol at least twice a week. Organ meat is typically richer in, well, just about everything. And it has a slightly different amino acid profile than muscle meat. So that means it has different proteins. And it tends to have proteins that we tend to be deficient in. So because when you look at ancestral perspective for a paleo diet, we didn't eat just muscle meats. And that's probably really important to have this organ meat in our diets to really round out the proteins that we're consuming. And then the other thing is I really like Dr. Wall's recommendations on eating lots of vegetables. She breaks it down into four categories, and I think this is fantastic.
Can you just say for a quick second who Dr. Wall's is? Because I know we talked about it earlier, and she was at AHS.
And we will definitely put a link to her website, which is terrywalls.com. There you go. In the show notes. But she is a physician who suffered multiple sclerosis, secondary progressing multiple sclerosis. I believe it was like an extra terrible multiple sclerosis. They're all bad. But and she was actually in a wheelchair, and she started researching sort of a nutrition link to treat her illness, because she was on, like, she was plugged in. So she was on all the experimental medications and still deteriorating rapidly. And she started with supplements like omega-3 supplements and various minerals. And then she had this like epiphany moment where she was like, what if I just eat the food that has this? And she, through her own research, came to a diet that looks very much like a paleo diet. She basically recommends all of these things. She has a few differences. She's, I've heard that she recommends like soy milk, and I'm not entirely sure why. She recommends playing with nightshades because not everybody has issues with nightshades. And from my reading, I quite disagree with that. I think nightshades are probably the most common problem of all of these foods with autoimmune disease. But she has a really strong focus on eating foods that are rich in specific minerals that your body needs. I mean, she's really focused on mitochondrial health, which is the energy center of the cell. So she recommends eating foods from sort of green vegetables, green leafy, even better, but just anything that's green. And then also cruciferous vegetables, which are things like broccoli and cabbage and kale and turnips and collard greens. And she recommends eating colorful vegetables, and she lumps in things like berries and with colorful vegetables. So eating lots of carrots and blueberries and beets and foods like that. And then also eating food sources of iodine. So I just mentioned that fish has iodine, but she focuses more on eating seaweed once or twice a week.
And I would totally agree with that, especially if people have thyroid-related autoimmune disease. I know I'm not a scientist, but I do know that iodine, often people who are paleo are, or anybody that's not eating a lot of processed food is deficient in iodine because it's fortified in table salt, and we often switch to sea salt or pink salt. And so finding natural sources of iodine can be very beneficial and helpful. And it would make sense that if you were, you know, living by the sea, that that would be an easy thing for you to have all the time. Think about how it's just like floating on the water when you go into the lake, you know.
I actually recommend for people with thyroid-related autoimmune disease that they try and consume seaweed at least twice a week rather than just once, which would be like a standard recommendation for anyone.
Have you tried the sea vegetable salt yet? I don't know the brand, and Matt can put a link in the show notes.
Just kelp, desiccated kelp, and use that as a salt.
So there's like a brand that they sell kelp salt, which is what you're talking about, but they also have a whole line of salts. And I'm saying this because I think it's very important and beneficial for people who are trying to get autoimmune under control, especially thyroid related. I put this on almost every breakfast I eat. It's just my habit. I have it in my desk at work. It's called sea vegetable sea salt. And it's like a combination of sea vegetables and sea salt. And it's much more palatable and kind of an almost MSG sort of wonderful flavor way. And I would highly recommend people give that a try if they're not ready to like full on take on sea vegetable, which I encourage you to do that because it's also good. But
my favorite way to get seaweed is actually kelp noodles. If people haven't played with kelp noodles, they're basically they're a raw noodle and you can eat them raw, but usually what you would do is you would rinse them and then throw them into your stir fry. I like it sort of with Asian flavors because it does have to me it just has a flavor that works with Asian flavors. It's not a really strong flavor.
I bet it would work with like clams or mussels, like a linguine kind of.
Yeah, really good with seafood. And a lot of people do like Italian sauces, and I've seen recipes on the various paleo recipe sharing sites for all kinds of pastas using kelp noodles. They're really easy. They're quite inexpensive if you can find them in an Asian grocery store. They're getting cheaper on Amazon, and I actually buy mine off Amazon. And, it's pretty fun. Also, the noodles are like 3 miles long. So we have so much fun. There's not very many long, stringy foods in a paleo diet. So we have so much fun. When I make stir fries, my kids get so excited because they get to eat these like super long, stringy noodles. And I have, I think, two recipes up on my site that uses them. So that's my favorite, like, seaweed to eat. And then I guess continuing the list of healing foods is bone broth. And this is because the amino acids in bone broth that are sort of broken down as you break down the bone, and especially the joints and the ends of the bones and the marrow, you get a lot of glycine, which is really the important amino acid here that is incredibly important for healing. And it's important. It's a major component of all of the connective tissue in your body, including all of the connections in between cells. So it's really, really important for healing. And, a GAPS diet would recommend basically having broth with almost every meal. I kind of say like once a day is a good goal. I probably drink broth 5 times a week. There's probably days where I skip. It's pretty standard for me to have just a cup of broth with my lunch. So I think, Stacey, can you think of any like follow-up questions that I should answer related to what the protocol is? I guess I should say that I have completely outlined the full autoimmune protocol, taking in the information from all the various experts on my blog, and I have an entire a menu just for autoimmune-related posts. So if you were like jotting all of that down and realized that you missed something, you don't need to rewind. You can just go to my blog and find the post, and it's all really clearly laid out for you.
I also have been, not from a scientific perspective, but I've been blogging about my personal experiences and what it is I'm specifically doing to address my issues. On the blog, you'll find it just sprinkled through July and August 2012, as well as I have a Pinterest board. And if you're not on Pinterest, you should be, because it's awesome. I have a Pinterest board of dedicated autoimmune recipes. So if you're feeling really limited, it's refreshing to see that there are breakfast ideas and there are dessert ideas and things that you thought you could never figure out how to eat ever again. And of course, Diane Sanfilippo's book has the entire protocol, nutrients to add, supplements to that she recommends, and a 30-day meal plan for autoimmune.
Yeah, and she actually recommended some neat supplements that I had considered playing with. And one of the ones, I've actually added two supplements to my protocol as a direct result of her book, which I'm trying out and still trying to figure out if they're helping. But I have been sleeping really, really soundly, and that might be because I gave up coffee.
Yes.
But I didn't give up all caffeine. I'm drinking black and some green tea. So I'm thinking it might be taking L-glutamine, which I started taking because of her book. So I really started sleeping soundly about 2 days after I started taking L-glutamine. Aww. It really was like that crazy. And I'm not – like, that's so not something I want to test. I don't want to stop taking L-glutamine and see if my sleep gets terrible. Go figure. I might have to test that at some point. But I feel like that is something that's really making a difference.
I felt like maybe we should very quickly, because I know we're running already out of time. We haven't even gotten to questions. GAPS versus SCD versus autoimmune paleo. So like my understanding of GAPS is that it's an elimination diet, very similar to autoimmune protocol, as well as SCD, which stands for specific carbohydrate diet. Do you have any information beyond their like sister diets?
Well, I mean, they're diets that have been around for a while. And they're diets that I think a lot of people who are dealing with allergy come to and then find out about paleo. I think especially GAPS diet is a very common, like, we're dealing with crazy health issues. We can't figure out what's going on. So we do this GAPS elimination diet. So the GAPS diet is actually based on the SCD diet. So SCD is specific carbohydrate diet, and it was developed by Dr. Sidney Valentine Haas. But the book, because we should put the books in the show notes for people who are interested, the book that was that popularized this diet was by Elaine Gottschall. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And it's called Breaking the Vicious Cycle. And the SCD diet was really based on foods that to address gut symptoms. So it was really like you have digestive symptoms and this diet addresses those. And it basically, it avoids grains, most legumes. There's a focus on probiotics. But it's just a diet. The GAPS diet is actually a whole protocol. So there's stages, there's recommended supplements, there's like baths in Epsom salts to help detoxify. There's a whole sort of group of recommendations around this diet. And it basically took the ideas behind the SCD diet and just took it to like a whole nother level. So the, you know, GAPS intro, which is the, you know, super strict elimination diet that you start with, is more restrictive than the SCD diet. I don't think they allow any legumes to ever be reintroduced back in, or maybe there's a couple, but not as many as SCD. And again, it's sort of one of those things, and they don't like dairy at first, but they do reintroduce dairy later. So there's definitely foods that you eat on those diets that are not compatible with paleo diet concepts. But there's a lot of things in common in terms of a focus on eating foods that heal the gut, on avoiding foods that irritate the gut, on avoiding foods that are inflammatory, on avoiding foods that feed bacteria and yeast that are not supposed to be living where they're living. And so there's some similarities in terms of that sense. And I would say that GAPS intro is actually more strict than the autoimmune protocol. But I think as you introduce foods back in with a GAPS diet, I don't agree with a lot of the foods that are being added back in. You know, I think the idea when you're doing the autoimmune protocol is that eventually you would try and add foods back in to get to a standard paleo diet, or maybe a standard paleo diet without nightshades, but something more along those lines. Whereas, you know, GAPS diet and SCD diet, you know, I think the idea is that you can add more and more things back in as you get healthy. And I think we're sort of looking at more of a long-term plan to stay healthy for the rest of our lives. Okay. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. And I would just like to take this opportunity to say my personal disclaimer. If you are currently eating legumes, or if you're using psyllium husk in your non-gluten baking, I ask people to stop today. So, like, my number one recommendation beyond going gluten-free is going legume-free. And I'm sure we all have our own specific, like, things that you think are bad. I've seen, and perhaps it's because I'm celiac, perhaps it's because I was a vegetarian for 7 years, perhaps it's because I don't have a gallbladder, but from what I've seen in my personal experience, especially with talking with other people who have digestive issues, autoimmune conditions, celiac, if you have any of these things, do not eat anything called a complex carbohydrate. Like, that is a, in my opinion, negative term. You should think of that as difficult to digest, which means not good for your gut health and healing. So I've been seeing a lot of recipes on websites that are being called friendly to these sort of diets. And I think a lot of people align, in my opinion, with like GAPS and SCD and paleo. They're putting those all into the same lump with, you know, also gluten-free, grain-free, and we're calling something that's grain-free if it has beans in it as a base, if it has psyllium husk in it as a base. That should be avoided, in my opinion, more than like white rice flour. I cannot reiterate strongly enough how much my family has seen benefits from completely removing legumes and seeds too, to a large extent, although we do sunflower seeds and pumpkin seeds, but like anything with a husk on it, anything that you wouldn't get if you were in nature, just don't do it.
Yeah. I basically like to say if it's the plant's reproductive parts, it's protecting its ability to reproduce. And so anything that is related to a plant being able to reproduce is potentially problematic. And that's where you see, a lot of, things that are restricted in the autoimmune protocol are things that, well, they're okay because they have these other protective mechanisms, but really they're seeds. You know, almonds are still seeds. And psyllium fiber is crazy.
Yeah, I don't want to get into it.
But there's actually like a paleo bread, and I can't remember the brand, which is probably a good thing.
I think it's called the paleo bread, and it
it's called the paleo bread, and yeah. It uses. And I've heard it. It looks very tasty. It looks like real bread.
No, thank you. And anything with a lot of flax in it. Like, if you have gas after you eat something, it's because your body's not happy. And I have gas after I have flax. So just, be aware of your digestion.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. There's this thing where you add flax to food to increase the omega-3 content. And I'm not a big fan of that because, first of all, the omega-3s that are in flaxseed are not very easily used by your body. They are the shortest chain omega-3 fats, the ALA fats. The fats that we actually need are DHA and EPA, which we get from animals that eat seeds like chickens and then make eggs that have a high omega-3 fat content, or fish who eat algae. I use flax in my baking for the chemistry of it, not for the, like, throw it in because it's going to add, omega-3s and healthy fiber. Like, it's not, I don't think of flax as being a superfood. I think of it as being a useful binder when I need something like that in a recipe.
Okay, so Sarah, are there any other things we're forgetting about autoimmune?
Yeah, I guess the last thing is that it's really important to adhere to a strict paleo diet and not to cheat. Like, other people get to cheat, but if you have an autoimmune disease, you really don't. And then the other thing is that a lot of people include dairy fat, like grass-fed butter or even heavy cream, in their implementation of a paleo diet. And with an autoimmune disease, we are often super sensitive to the proteins in dairy products, and so sensitive that even that trace amount that is left after clarifying butter and making ghee is like too much for our systems. Some people can handle it, some people can't, but definitely when you're first starting the autoimmune protocol, it's important to have no dairy whatsoever.
Agreed. I was actually dairy-free before I was gluten-free because I knew that I had that problem, and it is such a big cross reactor that it was more easily identifiable for me. So 100%.
Okay.
The next clip by popular demand is episode 17, Paleo 101, where in this Science with Sarah section, Sarah gives an overview on the theory behind why the paleo lifestyle is set up the way it is.
So normally for Science with Sarah, I try to go into some of the details about one specific concept within the paleo diet. But today I just want to sort of talk broad strokes about the health benefits of the paleo diet. And I will use a few geeky words because it's really hard for me not to. But what I really want to focus on is that the paleo diet is a whole foods diet where we only consume the most nutrient dense foods, and only consume foods that are linked to positive health effects. So foods that are anti-inflammatory, foods that provide the body with all of the macro and micronutrients that the body needs to be healthy, foods that are healing, foods that protect the integrity of the gut. And it's one of the concepts that we'll come back to over and over and over again is gut health. And that is one of the cornerstones of a paleo diet, that we eat foods that will heal our guts and reduce inflammation in our bodies. Now, inflammation is tied to pretty much every health issue out there. So when you adopt a paleo diet, you heal your gut, you reduce inflammation in your body, and you can see improvement in just about every health condition that exists. Inflammation is the root cause of cardiovascular disease. It's involved in diabetes. It's involved in cancer. It's involved in asthma, allergies. So any disease that you might be, or minor health condition, high blood pressure, all of these things can be improved with a paleo diet. A paleo diet really tackles the very basic physiology that is behind all of these health conditions that are sort of conditions that are considered diseases of modern civilization. So that they're diseases that are related to the high sugar, high gluten content, high processed food content, our fast way of eating, our stressed lives, our lack of sleep. All of these things are tied together, and the paleo diet can benefit everything. It's a fantastic diet for losing weight if you have weight issues. If you do not have weight issues, it's a diet that can be used to gain weight and get to a healthier weight that way. And really, it is a very scientifically backed diet where all of the nutrition choices are based on things that there's current high-quality science to back it up.
I think one of the things that was huge for me to understand, because most of what you hear through common talk is that, fat makes you fat. And I had definitely fat phobia when I came to the paleo diet and I used a low-fat approach. And there's certainly that's better for you than a standard American diet. But I found that I'm more satiated and more happy and energetic with a higher fat, lower carb approach. But I think what's interesting to me is that all of this stuff, almost all of it, even heart disease, asthma, arthritis, it's all linked to inflammation. And the general basics of a paleo diet are to remove inflammation, to remove the chronic inflammation in your body from the foods that you're eating so that your body can then, your immune system can then go and support the things that need help, like if you're battling the flu or if you have a broken bone or, whatever the case may be, if your gut isn't inflamed and all of your body's energy isn't spent on fixing that, then it can go do other things. And I think one of the most interesting things that I remember hearing that was kind of a light bulb in my head early on was that the majority of heart disease is actually caused by inflammation, that there's a lot of talk about cholesterol and fat and all that kind of stuff. But if you ask a doctor, well, what about inflammation? They'll say, oh yeah, yeah. Like inflammation is what causes it. So it's interesting that there's such a dichotomy of stuff out there, but that the key, in my estimation, to good health is to reduce the inflammation in your body. And, Sarah, you and I have tailored our paleo diets even further because we've realized that we can still have an immune response and inflammation in our bodies with standard paleo foods. So we go above and beyond and pull out some of the things that normal people don't really need to, because they might cause inflammation in more sensitive people, but in general, those foods are less inflammatory, so to speak, and easier to digest than, chemically laden, super processed flour and all that. Flour, corn, and soy are just in everything, and they're problems. So, yeah.
Yeah. So basically,
did I interrupt you? I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
No, you didn't interrupt me. I was done. Okay. I was just gonna throw out a summary sentence for people.
Perfect.
A paleo diet is a whole foods diet. We eat real food. We eat food that is anti-inflammatory and is healing and provides all of the nutrition that our bodies need for optimal health. And it is a diet that is known to heal and reverse a huge variety of health conditions. Good summary?
Yes.
All right.
And if you're looking for more information on that, the science, Sarah and I both have a lot of posts on our website with scientific references, either linked in or noted at the bottom, to give you that information. And, you know, we realize that on a podcast, we sometimes make general statements, but there is definitely science to back it up. You can also find more science at, and you can use the show notes for these links, chriscresser.com, balancebites.com, robwolf.com, marksdailyapple.com. We'll all have extensive scientific reference material for you to dig deeper into some of the stuff that we're talking about here. Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Next up is the question and answer section, where we covered a large variety of various topics. And the first one that we're going to play from you is from episode 17, the Paleo 101 episode, where we discuss paleo perfectionism, which is a very popular topic in the community and one that comes up in everything from Facebook posts to podcasts to books.
And I think it changes over time. You know, in the beginning, I was eating a ton of fresh fruit. Like, I'm sure I was eating multiple apples a day because I just didn't know what else to snack on. And those things were good to me and they're whole food sources. And going from eating, you know, pretzels to eating apples was a huge improvement, and it's totally fine. And so in the beginning, I'm sure I, like many people, probably had a higher carb ratio than I do almost, you know, 3 years later. The difference, though, is that I went from a super high carb diet, the standard American diet is a super high carb diet, to when I went to a paleo diet, eating multiple apples a day. I still had a huge reduction in carbohydrates, which was a big burden and alleviation on my body and my blood sugar, despite eating, you know, more fruit than I would eat today because it would not be comfortable for me today. My blood sugar was able to regulate itself because it was a huge improvement from what I had eaten. So I think there's this whole mentality of, paleo perfectionism is what, Diane Sanfilippo of Balance Bites refers to it as, and we'll link to her awesome post in the show notes. And it's really a pervasive thought among a lot of, who you and I consider to be, the leaders of this movement, Sarah, in that we really try to just do your best and know that your goal is to find a nutrient-dense diet for yourself, and you're trying to do the best that you can. But that if you have quinoa pasta because you just feel like spaghetti squash pasta isn't going to cut it, or your three-year-old is going to look at you and, you know, refuse to eat dinner, or you know, whatever the case is, as long as you understand what the food that you're eating is, what the repercussions are, and that's a choice that you're making, and that, you know, everything else about the meal is being improved because you're making it at home, you're using the right cooking fats, you're, you know, not putting a ton of processed pseudo cheese on top of your pasta, then you're way better off than you were before. And if, you know, I hear a lot of people say to me, well, I would go paleo, except I can't give up cream in my coffee. Then do everything else and don't give up cream in your coffee. Like, who cares? It's your body. It's your diet. If that's what you need and that's what you can't give up, then do everything else. And when you're ready and when you're healthy enough, you'll figure out a way to change that cream. But don't worry about it today. You know, we didn't talk about alcohol. We didn't talk about some other things that are gray areas. And we talked a little bit about treats. But Sarah and I both are kind of the mindset that, you know, food and social gathering and happiness in life are really important, and you should enjoy your food. And, you know, having occasional wine or, you know, choosing a gluten-free alcohol, whether that be gluten-free beer or hard liquor or whatever, you know, don't completely overdo it and go crazy, but at the same time, enjoy life. You know, you use this as a mechanism to make yourself have more energy. Use it as a mechanism to make yourself feel healthy. Use it as a mechanism to enjoy life. You know, for me, I went from only wanting to lay around the sofa watching TV 100% of the time to wanting to play with my kids, wanting to get out and do more. You know, I started a blog, I started a podcast, I wrote a book because I have energy to do that stuff that I never had before. And that's really what we're trying to get at here. It's not to be perfect. It's not to judge you or for you to judge yourself. It's really important to have a good, clean mindset and just try to eat whole foods to make yourself feel better and healthier. And, you know, if you do that for 30 days and you don't see improvement, let us know, because we've never heard of that happening. And we want to know.
Yeah. I'm really passionate about the concept of sustainability, and that means a lot of things when you talk about a paleo diet. But what I really mean is individual sustainability, of finding the balance that works for you. So finding that balance of, you know, still eating foods that you enjoy and loving your life and eating foods that make you healthier and give you energy and resolve disease. And for every person, that there is an individual balance, and that balance changes over time. As the longer you do the paleo diet, the easier it gets to figure out, you know, what to eat and how to find time to cook and where to buy your ingredients. And it becomes something that's a little bit more sort of a natural way to eat rather than effort. And when you first start, it's definitely effort, trying to figure out what's okay to eat and what's not. And so it's okay to just do the best that you can for now and work on transitioning slowly. Like, you know, some people do better with a cold turkey approach. I personally did a cold turkey approach, and that works really well for me. But my family took 6 months to transition to a paleo diet, and that's okay too. So we encourage you to, you know, get a good understanding of what you're eating and how that affects your body, and make the changes that are appropriate for you to improve your health.
Absolutely.
Up next is episode 3, Transitioning Kids to Paleo, a very popular demand when we were polling people on Facebook for their favorite episode. And the first idea that folks really enjoyed hearing about was how to craft menus with kids in mind.
All right, so these are our questions on transitioning kids to a paleo diet. These are mostly taken from our questions submitted via the web to the Paleo View podcast. A couple of them come from emails or from Facebook. Our first question is from Stacy, and she wrote, "Hello, I've been following you all for a while. I'm very ready to switch my family's way of eating with 5 kids. I have the kids who love sugar, grains, carbs. I would like to know where a good place to start is and where I can find some sample menus so we can get the show on the road."
Well, I would obviously say that Stacy should start with our websites. They're a free public resource. We've got tons of links and information about good transitioned foods, recipes, and blah, blah, blah. I would also highly suggest checking out Eat Like a Dinosaur. A lot of public libraries have it, or you can get it. It's only $20 on Amazon. It has some really good... The first chapter, we call the boring chapter for parents, talks about actually transitioning your kids and when and how to make concessions, some good transition guide tips. I would say for us, we transitioned to using less bread and using a tapioca-based gluten-free bread when we did switch. We have since moved on to Pure Wraps, which is a coconut-based rolled product. Like, you can make roll-ups with it, and also using fruits and vegetables as boats to hold protein. So we like to hollow out an apple and use that for a chicken salad, or we like to hollow out an avocado or a cucumber or a zucchini for tuna salad. I would say ask your kids what their favorite likes are. Put on a piece of paper what their favorite, you know, maybe 15 foods are, and there will be some whole foods on there, and exploit those whole foods. So for my kids, it was canned pineapple and black olives. We just put tons of those foods in the house, and whenever they were whiny or looking for something to snack on, we knew that that would be something that they would like. And I would say also, if your kids, depending on their age, if, you know, Stacey, you've got 5 kids. If you've got 1 or 2 kids and they're 3 and under, this isn't really applicable. But if you've got older kids, you know, transitioning and sometimes making concessions about using quinoa pasta on a special night or something like that, giving your children one special night to choose something that they want and making them understand this isn't the best health choice, but we realize that you really miss your food and we appreciate that you've been, you know, taking this journey with us, so we're going to eat this food and understand it's not the best for us, but it's also not the worst for us. We did some of that, and then we kind of changed those nights over to breakfast for dinner nights, which was really fun for the kids, and we would make, like, almond flour pancakes, or we made the waffles, the recipes in our book, and the kids got really excited about breakfast for dinner on Friday nights, and it was a completely paleo-based meal. I don't know, Sarah, what else do you think? What am I forgetting?
Well, yeah, I think what we did, because I transitioned my kids very slowly. I took, you know, well, legumes were really easy because we didn't eat a lot of legumes, and I just got rid of the peanut butter and bought almond butter. But our first focus was really gluten-free. And what I tried to do was, as much as I could, not replace with just gluten-free versions of their food. So, like, I did let my daughter eat Chex cereal in the morning for a while I was working on other paleo foods that she would like, trying to get her to eat eggs, trying to get her to eat bacon. She doesn't actually like bacon, crazy kid. And trying to sort of slowly introduce these other foods. So it was sort of get rid of gluten and then get rid of the gluten-free substitutes. And then after we had grains completely out of our diets, then I focused on dairy. Dairy was the last thing that we got rid of. And that was more just a question of just getting used to not eating cheese and having other foods that we ate as well. But at the beginning, I relied really heavily on paleo baking. So paleo breads, paleo muffins, paleo cookies. So a lot of these sort of nut-based baking. And that really helped my kids feel like they were still getting a treat. And then one of the nice things about a lot of those recipes is that you can slowly decrease how much honey or evaporated cane juice are in those recipes over time, make them less and less sweet. We had, you know, smaller and smaller portions and had them less and less frequently. And now we don't use them very often. So we did a very slow transition, and I've actually written a blog post that sort of outlines priorities for slowly transitioning your kids. And again, we really focused, just like Stacey did, on the foods that were paleo foods, you know, fruits, vegetables, and protein sources that my kids already liked. And we just had those more often. And so that was sort of the other aspect of it, was also, well, you already like carrots and apples, so we'll just have carrots and apples every day with our lunch. And then we'll play with some of these other foods and slowly, with a lot of encouragement, switch over.
Yeah, and I would say choice is a really important option too, which I think I forgot to mention. So, like, if you're going to have eggs for breakfast, something as simple as asking your child, if you would like scrambled eggs or fried eggs goes really far with my kids. Because then they still feel like they're in control, even though that you're choosing that today they're going to have eggs for breakfast. And also giving them some choice at the store and with meal planning. So, you know, obviously we always encourage that you cook with your children and let them be involved. But even before you're cooking, if you have an opportunity to take your children to the grocery store, letting them choose the produce for the week, or saying, you know, you get to choose one meal. Let's look on a Paleo Safe Pinterest wall, or let's look through Eat Like a Dinosaur, or let's look on the Paleo Moms website and you pick a meal. You'll know that it's a safe meal whatever they choose, because you've found a safe source. And then you go to the store and you let them choose the ingredients. Or if in the store, if you haven't planned ahead, you can still do that. My kids get to choose one piece of fresh produce every single week. And so it's really cool. Sometimes they'll choose, you know, peaches because they're in season at Trader Joe's and we didn't get them a farmer's market. And so they get super excited. And some weeks Cole will see celeriac, which is celery root. And he'll be like, what is this? I wonder what it tastes like. Let's check it out and let's bring it home and make it. And so it can be kind of an adventure and something that they get excited about if you let them choose. And at the same time, if they're well behaved and they've, you know, been eating their paleo foods and, you know, been great, then when they go to the store, we usually let them choose a treat, which can be something like almond milk yogurt, because in my house that has sugar, so it's a treat. Or Lara bars, or heaven forbid, Gorilla Munch cereal, which is a grain cereal, and they usually eat half a bowl of it and then ask for something else. But it makes them feel like they got a choice in something. And it's pretty interesting to see them kind of walk around the store and, you know, figuring out what the trade-offs are and what they're interested in. You know, it can be something like apricots as a dried fruit. So my kids are a little more advanced, so apricots as a treat might not be how you view apricots, but just to consider making them feel empowered by choice is often a really great way to get them on board.
Yeah.
What's next?
In episode 1, Paleo Kids in School, Stacy and Sarah share a bit about how to pack a paleo lunch.
So Stacy, I'm really excited to get to ask the questions. Now, the questions that I have today are not actually questions that were submitted to us by email, but they represent some of the most common themes to questions that I get personally on my Facebook fan page or by email, and that I'm sure you get as well. And that's really questions dealing with packing lunches and school lunch policies. So the first thing that I think about when packing a school lunch is I think about, well, two things. First is what food I'm actually going to pack, but also what am I going to pack it in? And I think that it's a really interesting topic for people who are looking at packing paleo lunches, which is not just a sandwich and an apple and a bag of chips. What do we pack them in? Because our needs for a container are kind of different. What are your favorite paleo-friendly lunch boxes?
Well, my personal favorite differs a little from my children. So from the perspective of what do I think kids like, my kids like normal-looking lunch boxes. I think it helps them feel a little better about their lunches. And then we have one more that is Goodbyn. It's Goodbyn. They love those because they come with sticker packs and they get to like decorate their dishwasher safe stickers that they get to decorate to make their Goodbyns look like they're monsters or robots or whatever. So they're okay with those when we have a really juicy lunch that kind of needs to be separated out. But usually they like a normal lunch box that kind of like comes free with the backpack that we buy at the beginning of the year or whatever the case may be. And then it's the containers inside that we use to kind of help us pack paleo-friendly lunches. So I really like reusable sandwich baggies. There's a million brands. I personally get mine off of Etsy, etsy.com. It's a craft conglomeration of a bunch of really cool crafters hosting their own kind of internal shops on that website. So you could do a search for reusable sandwich bag and have like probably 100 shops come up with all different kinds of fabrics and sizes that you might be interested in. So my boys are totally fine with those. We get some skull prints and some fire prints, and they like those reusable bags inside their Spider-Man lunch boxes. And then we also really like something called wrap mats. That's WRAPMATS. And I know Matt, who is the producer of our show and my husband, will be including some of these links in the show notes. So if you're not catching what I'm saying, but wrap mats are kind of like a dual functioning placemat and food container all in one. It kind of unfolds to be a placemat, and then you kind of fold it back up with Velcro to cover the food that you're eating. So when we make, like, let's say tuna boats, Matt can put the lettuce leaves inside the wrap mat, and then he can put the tuna in a separate container, and Cole can make his own lunch boats on the placemat at his lunch table. And we also use some pure coconut wraps, and it's really easy in that case to kind of like make those rolled up meat sandwich type things and put them in the wrap mat, because when Cole unfolds them, then they're kind of right there on the clean placemat for him. So those are my my three favorites. How about you, Sarah?
Well, I went and looked online and read reviews for every style bento box I could find, because for the way my daughter likes to eat, that kind of made a lot of sense. And I have completely fallen in love with Planet Box, but cannot afford to spend $60 on a lunchbox for my kid. I will ask for Santa to bring one this year for me, because Santa doesn't bring that kind of presents for the kids. But what we ended up going with was a container called an Easy Lunchbox, and you can go to easylunchboxes.com or you can buy them off Amazon. And they have three compartments that are all in one piece of plastic. One that's the size of a sandwich but works really well for fruit and vegetables, and then two sort of side compartments, and a lid that fits on tightly enough that it doesn't pop off, but it's actually easy enough for young kids to open. It's sort of almost designed for preschool and young elementary school age kids, and they're really inexpensive. They're like three for about $12 or $13. No, you get four of them, sorry. And that's what we've played with over the summer. Every time we go for a picnic, I pack them up so I can just sort of figure out where to put food and how much food goes in. And that's what we're going to at least start the year with. And they also have the bonus of sort of being a little bit more normal looking, and they're not going to be too different from what other kinds of plastic containers that kids have. So that's what we're going to try.
I think that's awesome. I haven't heard those, so I will check it out. I know the thing with the good bins is that there are multiple sizes. So I will say, like Cole is going into second grade. He's kind of just ready to upgrade, maybe midway through first grade. He was ready to upgrade to the larger regular good bin size. There is a toddler size with a lid. Like you said, a lot of the reviews and complaints that people have about not just the good bins, but overall the bentos, is that if you don't get the lid on right, then obviously they don't seal the liquid. So with smaller kids, especially kindergartners, you don't want them to come home with a wet, soaked homework.
Yeah, you either have a lid that you can take off easily, or a lid that actually keeps all of the stuff in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, whatever anyone chooses, just make sure that you're choosing an age-appropriate lunchbox, because I do think they vary a little. So.
And I'm not planning on sending anything very wet in this lunchbox. I mean, I think the wettest would be something like olives or cucumber slices, like not going to make a big mess.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be putting coconut milk yogurt or something in there.
Well, I know Cole likes sauerkraut in his lunches, which I know sounds weird, but we've made a mistake a couple of times of not using the right container for his sauerkraut, and having a sauerkraut juice soaked lunch pack come home with him was not very pleasant. So definitely
yeah, make that good would choices. Not be on my list of cool things to come home with my kid. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Still on episode one, Paleo Kids in School, Sarah and Stacy share tips on how to work with your kids against feeling different for eating the foods that they eat.
So I think we have time for just one more question.
Okay.
And that is, a lot of parents worry about their kids being teased or feeling different from the other kids because the foods in their lunch are very different looking from other kids. And I haven't had to deal with this yet because tomorrow's our first day of school. But have you had any experiences with Cole being teased at school or having, feeling like he, you know, he's being left out or he feels different because he eats differently? And how have you dealt with that?
Sadly, yes, I have dealt with this. I think for kindergarten, we did not have any problems. Like everybody actually, because I said they can't share lunches, the other kids in his class would tell Cole that they were jealous of what he was eating because it was interesting to them and they'd never seen it before. We used to pack him sea snacks, which are dried seaweed, roasted seaweed, super healthful, and they love them at home. The kids had never seen seaweed before, and so they were like, man, I wish I could have that because it kind of looks like a chip. When he got to first grade, though, about one-third through the school year, Cole started coming home a little more emotional than usual, and it took us a while to kind of get him to open up as to what was going on. And turns out the littlest thing of packing him seaweed had turned into a teasing at school, and he hadn't told us about it. We only realized it because the seaweed was coming home unopened, untouched. And, you know, Matt, who is the stay-at-home parent in our family and packs lunches, would say to him, Cole, what's wrong? Like, were you full today? Did you not want your seaweed? And he would say, no, I just wasn't hungry at school. I'll eat it now. And a couple times of that, we said, something's going on. You know, what's going on? And he admitted that the smell of the seaweed was so pungent that the other children had turned something from being interesting and unique in a kindergarten setting to being something different and teaseworthy in a first grade setting. And so what we learned, and this goes back to my original response to your question about how do we pack lunches, is that we needed to kind of make our paleo foods look a little more normal. Now, I would argue that paleo foods in general are more fun. They're more colorful. They're more energetic. They're more variety every day, you know, whether it's avocado one day and black olives the next day or, you know, canned pineapple and coconut yogurt. Like, my kid doesn't just get Dan and yogurt and Doritos every single day the way that a lot of other kids do. So that in and of itself does kind of go a long way. But to figure out kind of how other kids want to see things so that they don't stand out differently. And I know that that sounds kind of terrible, but there's always going to be someone in the class that's teased. And whatever you can do as a parent to kind of normalize your child is helpful. Also, you know, we tried to encourage Cole to stand up for himself and to say, you know, I'm eating this because it's healthy and I care about my body, stuff like that. But in first grade, that's a little more difficult. So for us, it was as simple as removing seaweed from his lunch. And for a while, we allowed him to pack vegetable chips or sweet potato chips to kind of replace that crunch that he was used to having. And that was like an immediate improvement in his quality of life. I mean, it's sad to say, but, you know, we just had no idea that that seaweed had turned from something cool to something not cool. And then the other instance of that was Valentine's Day, because our book came out last year and it came out in March. So we had early release copies in February and we were really excited to share the book with the class. And Cole had gone to the school and read the illustrated kids story and he was so proud of himself and he was so excited. And
that's awesome.
You know, all the teachers and the librarian, we donated a copy to the school and stuff like that. Everyone was just like giving him high fives in the hallway. And they were like, Cole, we can't believe how far you've come. Both, you know, his behavioral issues resolved, his asthma resolved. The book talks about the changes that he made in his life and how it improved his health. And so a lot of the people in his life were impressed in the school and he was proud of it. And so he was like sharing that with his classmates. And of course, other children probably out of jealousy teased him about having a different diet because the book made it very clear that he was different. You know, it was like, yes, he has these food intolerances and it makes him a different person. So the week following when we shared that story was Valentine's Day, and Cole came home almost in tears one day, and he curled up in my lap. He's not really a snuggler. He curled up in my lap and just kind of sobbed to me that he was afraid that his stickers and erasers that we were going to give as Valentine's treats, that people would make fun of him. And he said, you know, the people in my class just don't seem to like my paleo diet. It makes me sad. He doesn't call it paleo diet. He calls it gluten-free, dairy-free. But, you know, it makes me sad that my friends are going to make fun of the food that I'm eating. And it was about 7:30 at night on February 13th. And he and I got in the car immediately, and we drove to Target, and we got Annie's fruit snacks in pink and red colors, and we put them in with his Valentine's cards instead of the stickers and erasers, and he went to school beaming the next day. And I have absolutely no guilt about having done that. Like, Annie's fruit snacks is not something that's going to kill any kid, especially what the rest of them were eating on Valentine's Day. And it made my child feel totally normal to buy something at the store that was pink and red and give it to his classmates and feel normal. So I just think, like, where you find opportunities to, you know, blend and bend a little, take those opportunities. Don't do it too often, but I think, you know, listening to your children's emotions and reacting appropriately is really key to their social development.
Awesome. So I think we can move on to the next segment.
Cool. Moving right along.
Also falling under the transitioning your kids to paleo topic is episode 11, What's Up with Dairy, where Stacy and Sarah share information about what to serve your kids instead of milk at meals.
So that's an excellent transition to the next question from Melanie from Dallas, Texas, who writes, my kids go to school, breastfed both until they were 6 months old, and then gave formula. My three-year-old loves cow milk. My 11-month-old daughter is drinking formula now. We started eating paleo at home around April 2012. They still get the standard American diet at daycare and school. I think the cow's milk is affecting my son's seasonal allergies and creating more mucus and would like to get it out of his diet. So the question is, what do you give your kids instead of milk? Do you give them almond milk or coconut milk? Any suggestions on what to give my 11-month-old daughter after she turns one? Continue on formula and just ditch the milk stuff altogether? Until what age? Wish I would have just breastfed both longer, but so hard when working too. Would like to send along something else for them to drink when they go to daycare so they can drink something besides water there. Everyone else is drinking milk or juice. Thanks. Love you guys.
My kids drink water. And that's difficult to transition. So there's certain things that you can do. We kind of have always given water, but for the baby, you can put a little bit of juice. When I say a little bit, I mean at the most like a 1-to-4 ratio to kind of sweeten the milk, because your breast milk is naturally sweet. She'll be more likely to drink it if it's got a little bit of sweetness. When all of my boys went off of getting my pumped breast milk during the day, which is essentially what you're doing at that year mark with formula, they started getting kind of milk and nutrient-dense foods like liver. And with Wesley, because we were paleo, we did full-fat canned coconut milk. And we recommend the Natural Value brand. It's BPA-free. It doesn't have any xanthan gum, guar gum, or anything else in it. I don't know of any other brand that can say all of those things except Aero D in the boxed container. Anyway, so for Wesley, we gave him water and we gave him coconut milk smoothies. We got his nutrients through food. I mean, it's the same way that you get your nutrients as an adult. You think about it, like a year-old baby is perfectly capable of eating food, and our nutrients should come from things that you're chewing and you're properly digesting by kicking off the digestive process with chewing. If you try to give too much nutrients with fluid, I've heard of a lot of people having trouble kind of moving to more tough, solid foods at like the 2-to-3-year mark. Children often have difficulty chewing meats and other food that require a lot of jaw muscles. If they don't start developing the muscles at that younger age, then they don't build up to what you're going to want to give them when they're older. That said, we do occasionally let our children take, our preference is coconut milk because we are trying to go nut-free with the autoimmune protocol, although in the beginning we did a lot of almond milk, and I don't know that there's necessarily a problem with that. If you don't have a problem with that, we just prefer coconut milk. Specifically, for things like when we have birthday parties, when we're hosting something and we want kids to be able to have something, we get those like mini bottles of water, and we get like chocolate coconut milk to go with cakes if kids want like milk with their cake or something. But we don't even really buy juice. Like, we never buy, it's just so sugary and it's not really offering anything to the kids. I think I found a brand when I first transitioned to paleo, and we bought like that was a low sugar brand, and I took a sip and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just watered down juice. Like, why am I paying money for this? And we stopped doing it. Like I said, we also occasionally do alternative yogurt products. So there's coconut milk yogurt, there's coconut milk ice cream, there's almond milk yogurt and almond milk ice cream. Just be aware that those are transition foods. Those aren't like optimal whole food sources. So long term, try not to, you know, make a
They tend to have thickeners, yes, emulsifiers. They tend to have gums like guar gum or xanthan gum. They often have something like rice starch as a thickener. So, you know, read the labels and make sure that you're aware of other, like, where some of those ingredients might be problematic for your family. We couldn't tolerate the store-bought coconut milk yogurt at all because of the rice starch in it.
Yeah. We, you know, it's an occasional food for us. The boys understand that it's a treat. Like, when we go to the grocery store and they're well-behaved or they've had a great week, they're allowed to pick out a treat from the grocery store. And the treat parameters are pretty much paleo foods. Like, they never get any non-paleo foods. It's just a higher sugar content usually. And one of the things that they'll choose is either like a 4-pack of coconut milk, or they'll choose coconut yogurt. Like, that's a treat for them. You know, they don't think of that as like an everyday thing. Now, is that where we were 2.5 years ago? No. 2.5 years ago, I was happy just to have an alternative to get, you know, the casein and the gluten out of their foods. We even ate things like corn chips. But depending on where you are in your journey, these things can be really good, helpful tools. Or, you know, if you're far enough along your path to someone else that might be listening to this, that you might be able to think of those things as treats. I just think it's really important, Sarah, you and I have talked about this many times, and I think it's a constant recurring theme in our show, is that, you know, we feel like it's important to walk a balance of helping our kids be healthy and also helping them feel normal. And a coconut milk yogurt goes a really long way with our kids. So do little applesauce containers. So do like those canned fruit in the plastic containers that are in juice. Like, those aren't, you know, super healthful foods. They're higher in sugar, but they come in a package that looks like everybody else's packaged foods. And so those can just be really helpful when you're transitioning your children.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't see a really strong need for a milk substitute, if that is sort of the point of the question, is, you know, do you have to give almond milk or coconut milk? My kids also just drink water. And my youngest was a milk hound before we cut out milk. And she would drink like 36 ounces of milk a day. And so with her, she didn't like the milk substitutes. She didn't like the milk substitutes if I mixed them half and half with cow milk. And so if I offered her a milk substitute, she would just drink water. So we just stopped offering cow milk. We stopped having it in the house. And she just started drinking water. And it didn't take very long before she figured out that she was just drinking water. Now, she's a really easygoing kid. And I mean, that, if my oldest had loved drinking milk, I don't think that would have been anywhere near as smooth a transition, because my oldest is not as easygoing. But there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with just water. and or watered down juice. Or if you want to do almond milk or coconut milk, that's fine. Just know that most store-bought almond milks and coconut milk that are sort of that cow milk-esque texture that they sell in the cartons, they tend to have a lot of emulsifiers in them. So they tend to have carrageenan or guar gum or xanthan gum. I mean, I've seen coconut milk with titanium oxide in it just to make it whiter. So so just have a look at the ingredients and then, you know, do the best that you can. Stacey, what do you think about the transition from formula to water? Just kind of do it slowly over a few weeks? Slowly cut down the formula and increase the water or water down the formula? What do you think?
I'm not sure what the, like, standard pediatrician recommendation is, but I think the thing to focus on is making sure that you're replacing those nutrients. So, you know, with this, I think what the standard recommendation is, you switch from formula to cow's milk because it has a similar nutrient profile. So for me, that just meant focusing on making sure that my children were getting, you know, as much or more nutrient dense food than what would have been equivalent to what they were consuming in a liquid format. So, for Wesley, we let him eat from the table, but we also kind of always had like a container of some sort of organ meat dish or puree that had been, bone broth had been added to, or, you know, we would give him more eggs than other, people in the, like, basically we would serve him eggs and the side dishes if we felt like he wasn't going to get enough nutrients from whatever, protein we were serving. So, some other really good ideas, especially now that it's getting fall weather, or a lot of braised meat and that you can add broth to. So stews are a perfect kid food. They're kind of soft on the jaw and you can add your own homemade bone broth. Or if you make a stew type food with something, with a bone in it, you'll get your own broth if you just add some water and flavorings. I know, Sarah, you and I both have a ton of recipes on our site for those kind of braised recipes. There's a ton on the internet, both for braised food recipes as well as making your own milk. There's cashew milk, almond milk.
I have a recipe for coconut milk on my site.
I've even seen flaxseed milk. Like, it's all over the internet. You just search and it's there.
You could even try the, like, Weston A. Price Foundation liver-based formula substitute if you want to.
Yeah, that does have dairy in it, I think it, but if you're not, you know, turning off dairy yet, that's another thing to consider. Other things are nuts. Nuts are high in calcium, so you can make some nut butters and offer that as a dip with fruit. That's super popular with kids.
My kids just like it off the spoon.
Oh, yeah. Just the other day, Finn's like, I like it when you make me ants on a log, but just the sun butter part. Yeah. And then I eat the raisins. Like, yeah, that's what I thought. So, but kids are just huge fans of, like, dips and sauces in general. So if you can figure out ways to make sauces with bone broth and using nuts, using greens, using fish, all of these things are high in calcium and all the other nutrients that you would be looking for in milk, then you're kind of the same as or better than if you were giving them milk, in my opinion. I'm not a doctor, but think about it. From a doctor perspective, they're asking you to switch to cow's milk because it has a similar nutritional profile. So if you can figure out how to give nutrient-dense foods with a similar profile, you're doing the exact same thing. You're just giving it in a food format rather than a liquid format.
So the next question is from Kelly from Federal Way, Washington. We are slowly transitioning the family to paleo. One of our biggest hurdles is what to give the kids to drink in place of milk at every meal. The older two, ages 15 and 8, do not like coconut milk, and now the younger two, ages 4 and 2, listen to the older two and don't like it. We have been brainwashed to think that our kids need milk at every meal. The kids will drink water during the day. By dinner, they are ready for something different. What do you give your kids to drink at meals?
Water.
Water. That's it. That's all we drink. Water.
I think something really important to consider is that the more fluid you drink at a meal, the more diluted your digestive enzymes are. And so we've kind of also been brainwashed to think that we need fluid to wash down our food. if you pay attention to the food that you're eating, you're probably halfway chewing, taking a sip and washing it back, which is what I was doing before. So part of what I do now is really focus on digestion. I focus on chewing, and I usually don't even have a drink in front of me at the table. I have a little bit of glass of water to take my supplements, or I might have a glass of wine to kind of sip on, but I don't drink at meals anymore. And I think it's a really good habit with kids too. If you put a giant glass of fluid in front of them at the dinner table, the likeliness of them consuming it and perhaps filling their bellies with liquid and then being hungry later, or perhaps diluting their digestive enzymes and then not processing their nutrients that you're giving them properly, are highly likely.
My kids have their normal like water cups that they would have throughout the day or just sort of put on the dinner table, and they don't particularly drink a whole lot at dinner time, but they don't, you know, there's no rules. It's just sort of like listen to your body and whatever you need type thing. And my kids don't seem to get bored of water. Sometimes we mix it up and throw some ice in there, and that's really, really, really exciting when we have ice in our water. And then it usually becomes a big play thing, and ice gets melted all over the table, and then there's a big mess for me to clean up, so that's why it's a fairly rare occurrence in our house. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with giving your kids water at meals, and they'll get used to it.
I would say 15 is probably about the age that it's difficult to argue this stuff with, so you know, it might be it's not in the house and that's their choice. Or the other thing, if you're willing to do this, is we have a SodaStream machine, which is, to most people, a soda-making machine. But we don't buy the syrup. We just carbonate our water and we'll put some fun things in there. I think we have some recipes on the blog from a while back when we did a review of SodaStream. Matt likes to put a little bit of clementine peel, like with the orange of a, with the oil of the clementine skin, like you would be peeling it in, with some almond extract. Other things that we like are mint extract, or muddle fresh mint in there. You can also do, we've even done like anise extract to make it kind of a root beery flavor. You can always add like a couple of drops of Splenda if you're trying to really transition your kids that are used to soda. But that could be a fun alternative to water to kind of transition. I would guess that a 15-year-old making their own soda stream before dinner would be really exciting. And if the worst thing that you're putting in there is extract and maybe a couple drops of stevia, that's a really good way to transition away from regular milk.
That's a cool idea.
We do that sometimes. Like, Matt loves soda stream, but we don't really drink it at the table.
I buy, like, carbonated water, like Pellegrino, and then add in some fresh lemon juice, which I guess is the same thing without the equipment.
It's so much cheaper to get a soda stream, in my opinion. Like, because those canisters are refillable, so it's green and long term. Like, you know, we bought this soda stream a year ago. We've been refilling the containers with the exception of the one time Matt put them in the dishwasher.
Yeah, I bought a case of Pellegrino 2 years ago, and I think there's still like four bottles in it. So
You're not drinking it very often.
It's not something that I do a whole lot.
But so. I do think it would be for a child as old as 15. It's
true, you might
different.
Be using it a lot more, which makes it much more cost effective.
So, there you go.
Also by popular demand, episode 43 on eating disorders, George from Civilized Caveman joins Stacy and Sarah to answer questions, one of which really struck a chord with many of our listeners, which was on how to identify an eating disorder.
This question is from Anonymous, and he writes...
I don't think it's a he.
It might be a she. He or she writes, I apologize.
It's anonymous. We don't know.
It's anonymous.
Anonymous writes.
Anonymous writes, I was a personal trainer at Gold's Gym. A couple of the guys I worked with were getting ready for a show and wanted me to diet with them. This is why I thought it was a guy, because I was thinking personal trainer at Gold's Gym. Could be a girl. I'm sure women work out at Gold's. Okay, sorry. On with the question. I didn't compete, but did the diet. I'm 5'1.5". When I started the diet, I was 125 and got down to a lean 112. I kept losing weight afterwards and got down to 99 pounds. I exercised 5 to 6 days a week, mostly strength training and sprinting. I wasn't trying to lose weight. People said I was too skinny, so I started to become more lax with what I was eating. I went through a bout of irritable bowel syndrome, and that's how I stumbled upon the paleo lifestyle. I love it and wish I could be 100% paleo. So people telling me I was too skinny was sort of a green light for the foods I was more or less restricted from my bodybuilding diet. I developed bad habits of overeating and I think binging, not quite sure of the definition. My favorite foods to splurge on are almond butter, coconut butter, nuts and seeds, and dried fruits. Do I have a binge eating disorder? And if so, how do I stop? I live with my parents, who are not paleo, so it's hard to do the just don't have it in the house method. I have done the 21-day sugar detox, level 3, with ease. I'll down half a jar of almond butter and say that's it, then 3 days later I'm at it again. I hate it. I hate not being in control. Please help.
You want first stab, George?
I'll go for it. Here we go. I can do this one. So, well, now that we've established that it's anonymous, forgive me if I say he or she. I have no idea, and I'm just going to make my best recommendation here. So, there's a lot going on in this question. It sounds very familiar to my life, which is what landed me in close to my boat that I was in for a while. So I used to be a personal trainer at Gold's Gym, and the first bodybuilding competition I ever did was when I was sucked into it to do it with a bunch of friends, and that's what led to me gaining weight before my injury and my surgeries. But yeah, it's a little crazy reading this one. It's about down memory lane. But what I think is going on here is and I'm gonna go outside of this question real quick and kind of just address something else. So one thing when I was into bodybuilding and I was a trainer and I was doing all that, the restriction and the level of things that you deprive yourself with at that level is, it's a little insane. I have people tell me all the time that paleo is hard, or the autoimmune protocol in particular is hard, or anything along those lines is hard. But I mean, I lived off peanut butter, chicken breast, and broccoli for close to like 2 years of my life doing that. And you know, the whole mentality in that sport and that culture is that you bulk, and binge eat whatever you want. And then you diet down for 12 to 16 weeks, eating strict foods, depleting yourself of water, cutting all salt out for a show. And then the day after the show, you put 25 pounds back on and get right back to bulking weight or whatever the case may be. And it's just not healthy at all. And your body is not meant to go through that. So that's my splurge about that one. But, you know, reading this, my favorite foods to splurge on are almond butter, coconut butter, nuts, seeds, and dried fruits. Well, that sounds like my daily life, to be completely honest with you. I love almond butter. I love coconut butter, nuts, seeds, and dried fruits. The key for me is just to keep them in moderation. I don't know if I would say that you have a binge eating disorder, as much as you might have some dysregulated hormones or some, you know, insulin resistance going on, or something's going on at a different level, just from a few things that may need to be tweaked. From what it sounds like, you eat meat, good fats, you get your carbs from veggies, you get plenty of sleep at night. You could be overtraining. It could be a multitude of things, or you could just not be eating enough. One thing that I find is that, when I'm training heavily or CrossFitting 3 to 5 times a week, I'm not a big guy. I only weigh 170 pounds now. And, you know, sometimes when I come home, I'll make a quick meal and I'll find out like an hour later that I'm just getting cravings of the yin yang. And I'm like, wow, man, I eat clean. I'm doing like a whole 30. And what I found is that sometimes I'm just not feeding myself enough. And I think people underestimate the value for how much food they eat. They keep certain standards and guidelines for how they should eat, and they don't take into account all the work and the training that they're doing. And if you're continually underfeeding yourself and training at a very, very high level, or working hard towards something like that, you can go down the road of leading yourself to want to binge and want to crave those sugary foods because your body's in emergency mode. So I don't think that you have a binge eating disorder, but I do think that it's amazing that you're aware of it, and I applaud you for writing the question. And And just from that alone, I know that you're conscious of it and you can take the steps to avoid letting it develop into a problem by taking control now. And, you know, from what it sounds like, the 21-day sugar detoxes are easy with you, and probably a whole third will be easy. But what I think that relates to is the bodybuilding mentality, and you have to stop thinking about them as 21 days or 30 days and having an ending period. You need to take the steps that are necessary now to eat like that every day and eat healthy to fuel your body and your mind and go down that road and stop looking at it like it's an interim time frame. You know, the time frame is the rest of your life, and it needs to be this day, tomorrow, 6 months from now, and a year from now. You know, call it a whole 1 year if you'd like, or just a paleo diet for the rest of your life. But I think taking the stipulations off it with the time frames will do a lot for you, because instead of waiting to the end of it and going on a week or two binge, you know, if you have a weekend and you're like, hey, you know, I had a half a cup of almond butter and knocked down some coconut butter with some almonds and macadamia nuts, you know, but you do it once and you do it every, you know, 20 days or just when the urge happens, you know, you're slowly going to cut that out and you're going to get control of the situation, and you're going to head right down and stay on that positive road instead of this vicious cycle where you're strict, 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 and then you binge, and then you're strict, 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 and then you binge, because you're creating a behavior and a habit in yourself that is going to turn into a bigger problem. So no, in short, I don't think you have a problem. I think it's amazing that you recognize this and you're able to ask the question. And I think if you take the right steps, then you're going to be completely fine.
Stacy, I think you and I can retire. I was basically going to say, like a way less eloquent version of the same thing, that to me it sounds like Anonymous is probably under eating.
Yeah.
And it's probably, with all of the training that he or she is doing, it's stressing their body. So they end up having these food cravings for, you know, those foods are really calorie dense foods. And that is sort of a classic cortisol food craving, to be craving really, really calorie dense foods. And, you know, cortisol is increased from, strength training, and it's increased even more if you're not, eating enough in the sort of few hours after a really intense workout. So, I was just going with like really intense food cravings because of not eating enough for the amount of training that this person is doing.
That's exactly how I read that question, is, you know, that was a lot of weight to lose. And, I just feel like as much as those are calorie dense foods, they're not necessarily nutrient dense foods. And so I would hope that, if this person was experiencing an urge to eat these things, to not think of it necessarily as a splurge, or I kind of got a sense from reading this question, like they were being down on themselves. From some of the other information they gave us, it was like, you know, I think I'm binging. Binging is not something that you think about. I don't know, George, if you feel the same way, or Sarah, but like binging is not something you're like, oh, I think I'm binging. If you're a binge eater, it's kind of an uncontrollable,
compulsive
emotional thing. There's no thought involved. It's like you are kind of zombied and it's the food takes over, and the food kind of fills this, oftentimes, at least for most people I've talked to, emotional void for whatever reason that you might be having. I don't get that sense at all here. I get a sense of someone who sounds to me like they need to eat more food, and their body is telling them to eat some of the things that probably taste good to them, that have calories. And I would say they need to probably add more fat to the regular foods that they're eating, because almond butter, coconut butter, nuts, and seeds are all very high in fat. So maybe more avocado on your salad, maybe more lard in your vegetables or your cooking fat. Make sure that you're eating plenty of food. It doesn't sound to me like there's a weight problem at all. So even if you, you know, had even if you started to eat a lot more food and then it caused you to gain a couple of pounds, I think, you know, there's not a concern here in playing with where the sweet spot is to fulfill you, to satiate your appetite without, you know, needing to snack on other foods. The one thing that we didn't really talk about is that Anonymous says that they went through a bout of IBS. That's how they stumbled into paleo. They love it and wish they could be 100% paleo. I'm not quite sure what else is going on there in terms of what they're not eating that isn't paleo. I know they say they live with their parents, so it's difficult.
Good call.
You know, a lot of what we talked about in the last question, if you're eating gluten, it could prevent nutrient absorption, which, you know, could cause the opposite effects that we've talked about. Oftentimes with celiacs, they're either, I'm not saying that this person's celiac, just as an example, either obese because they're not absorbing nutrients, or they're severely underweight because they're not able to absorb their food. So if you've got IBS and it's running through you and you're not absorbing your nutrients, you know, a focus on getting to that paleo, which I would argue, you know, could be done in a parent's house if you're able to avoid the food that isn't paleo. But, you know, the great thing about paleo is that you can eat meats and veggies and fruit, and that's a paleo diet. And even most standard American households have those foods in them. So I know it's more difficult willpower-wise, but if you can try to get to where you're eating, you know, a paleo template, a primal template, ancestral diet, whatever you want to call it, and avoiding the foods that would be irritating your gut and causing IBS, that could probably be a significant contributor to getting to a healthy weight and not craving foods as well.
Yeah, good call.
Cool. And I would say, too, the reason I point that out is 90% of the time Sarah and I are getting these questions. I mean, we've said before, these are representative questions. We're not able to do four-hour podcasts and every week and cover all the questions we get as much as we would love to do that for everybody. It's just not going to happen. But these are really representative questions of what we get. And 90% of the time, the questions that we're getting, people are often answering their own questions in what they're submitting. So what we really hope that we've done with the show is kind of pointed out, you know, where, like George recommended, sit down and write down what you're feeling and what's going on. You know, either pretend to write us a question or write us a question, and then a couple of days later, come back and look at it and see if you can see kind of what we're pointing out here in terms of, you know, having an emotional attachment to food, perhaps, you know, not eating exactly what you should be eating, and that could cause hormonal disruption, sleep disruption, all that kind of stuff. Something we didn't really talk about on this show. I know, Sarah, you talked about sleep being a significant contributor to you. When I am stressed, I like to eat sweets at night, period. End of story. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that way for almost everybody.
Yeah. I crave sugar, especially in the evening.
In the evenings, right. And it's such a snowball effect because when you eat the sweets at night, it spikes your blood sugar, and usually it's caffeinated, and it gives you a rush of false energy. So then you have a difficult time wanting to be sleepy, wanting to be tired, wanting to go to bed. So you stay up late, and you cause this cycle for yourself over and over again. And it's really difficult to break. I mean, it's difficult for me to break. And I've been doing this for years. I've been, you know, a recovering bulimic. Like George said, I don't want to ever use the word recovered because it's not like the journey ends. It's an always and forever thing that you have to deal with emotionally. But this is something that I've been doing for, you know, over a decade. And still, I am able to look myself in the eyes and say, you are having an emotional food craving right now. And that doesn't mean that I don't want it. What it means is, like I said earlier, I oftentimes choose something that's a little better choice. But I'm not going to, you know, make myself feel bad or guilty that, you know, I ate something, and I'm also not going to make myself feel deprived, which then will cause even more disordered eating. So, you know, I have an apple with sun butter, or I have coconut date rolls, or I have bacon wrap dates, or I have bacon, or I find things in my own personal life that I feel like are gray area foods that, you know, satisfy that emotional need that I need without necessarily creating turmoil in my health. And I think that those are really important things to focus on when you're looking at your overall emotional health with food is, you know, what is your relationship with food and how are you responding to it? And try to make those steps that you can towards making better choices. And if you don't make the best choice, you get to make another choice 10 minutes later. You know, it's really difficult to hear that because I know if you have disordered eating, you're already beating yourself up as it is. You're already not confident. You're already not, you know, respecting yourself. So the ability to say, I made a mistake and that's okay and move on is extremely hard. But it's also one of those things that should be really prioritized because there's nothing you can do about it. It's done. It's over. Move on. Because if you dwell on that and if you really beat yourself up on it, you're only going to go to worse places mentally. So I just think, you know, if Stephanie Ruper were here, she would say to focus on loving yourself and forgiving yourself and those kinds of things are really important.
Yes.
I'm nodding and
I felt like I needed a sound effect there.
Yeah, I was just going to let, I think we were, that was the, like the start of the slow clap. We just kind of had to let it marinate so people could understand how important it was.
Okay.
That's what I would say if I said it. So, you know, whatever works. If you own it, then everyone else will believe it.
Cool.
Hello. Okay. Yeah. Oh, just like
we were slow clapping you, George.
Yes.
Well, and I would just like to say as a comment to all of the wonderful stuff you just said, bacon.
The third most requested topic that people asked for when polling was George. That was what they asked for, George. And in episode 47, we feel that he is best showcased for all the reasons why we love him in the exercise discussion, where he not only gives Sarah some training on what Prancercise is and how to incorporate it into your household chores, but also to give a little love to the ladies to remind them to love your body for what it is.
I guess it's actually a good time to talk about it because I really do enjoy just like really staying like lighthearted and fun about it. Like I don't really ever flip about missing work. I mean, I used to be really, really structured. Like when I was training CrossFit and competing all the time, like, oh my God, I can't miss a workout. Oh my God, it's training day 27 and it's training day 36 and I have to eat this and I have to do this. And I mean, I would feel like absolute dog poop and I'm sitting here doing like 2 hour workouts and I was never happy. It was like a very monotonous and like sludging along kind of mentality, and it wasn't really fun for me. And yeah, I got stronger, but I never really enjoyed it, and it kind of devalued it to me. And I think that it should be enjoyed and should be fun, and movement and play is something that I really enjoy. So I stopped competing, you know, for injuries and a few other reasons, but now I don't stress about it. If I can't go to CrossFit, I literally do handstands in my house, or I work on my strict press, or I go in the backyard and play on the slack line that I put in my backyard, or I'll go to the trampoline park, or go for a run, or go do sprints, or go steal my friend's dog, or their kids, whatever.
Fly across the country just to play with kids.
Yeah,
for a few days.
I did fly to DC just to play with the kids to exercise because I couldn't CrossFit. So, I mean, you can take it to the extreme if you choose. That's just my personality. But yeah, I just think it's really important to keep it into perspective. I mean, I know a lot of people really intimidated, like Stacey talks about a lot when it comes to exercise, especially like group exercise or really tight-knit communities like CrossFit or anything along those lines. It can be very intimidating, especially when you don't know. So I think it's just important to remember that we're literally, if you do it to have fun, it's going to relieve a lot of the pressure. Like for what it's worth, I mean, you wouldn't really know, but when I go CrossFit, 99% of the time I do the prescribed weight. I've been doing CrossFit for a while, so it's pretty easy for me. But most of the time I don't write my time on the boards because for me, it's not about, you know, if I beat someone else or if I do this. To me, it's about if I do it the best I can with the right form and for the right reasons. If I stop enjoying CrossFit, I'm going to stop doing it because I'm not in the mindset where I'm going to make myself go do something I don't enjoy anymore. And I'll move on to something else, whether it's mountain biking or road biking or yoga, which I got my butt whooped at today, or, you know, Pilates, if that case may be. I mean, I'll even jazzercise and whip up my Susan.
Oh, no, what's the lady?
Oh, Prancercise. I will totally go start Prancercising if I have to.
If you guys don't know what that is, Monica's going to put a link in the show notes, and you have got to watch it.
Yes. Yes, and I, you know, I would describe it for you, but I will not do
it. You just can't do it, Justin.
Any valid justice. I won't even get in the same universe as the level of awesome that you're going to see when Monica links to this video. So, with that being said, I'll end on the note that, you know, if you are looking for a change in your fitness routine, then don't be afraid to try Prancercising. And if you do, even though this is not my podcast, please, please, email the show and let them know about your experience. And pictures and videos.
I was going to say, videos welcome.
Are very welcome for social proof that you gave it a valiant effort.
Yeah, how do you top that one, sir?
You don't. I was going to say something about importance of having fun. And
we got that card.
Kind of cheap stress, but oh my goodness, that's great. I'm like crying. I'm laughing so hard.
Have you seen Prancercise? Because I know sometimes you don't know about these things.
I don't.
Oh, it's so sad for you.
Well, you know what I'm going to do.
Yes, you can't do it while we're recording, though, because the video is 6 minutes and 19 seconds long, if I remember. I may have watched it maybe 45, 50 times by now. Okay, so moving on from Prancercising, just for the sake of... Because if people are listening to this, they're going to pause it. And
please, do it.
If you're driving, please do not watch it on your phone. Can you wait till you get to work or something? That's the disclaimer for paleo parents right now. You don't do it. Don't do it. Or you may have an overwhelming urge to park your car and Prancercise all the way to the office. So just don't do it. So, yeah, but fun, Sarah. That's a good segue. We can get back to fun now.
Yeah. Oh, wait. No.
Oh, I hear her voice.
Oh, my God.
I hear her voice. Shut it off, because now I'm going to Prancercise.
Oh, okay. No, I will. It's you muted.
Prancercise on the treadmill desk after this.
Just in case you were wondering, Sarah, that is the video.
That's the right video? Okay. Yeah. Excellent. I will watch this and we can can watch it later. You know what? Just the thumbnail from the video is kind of funny.
It's pretty epic. All right. I think we have some questions.
We've got some questions.
Good thing you guys stop me. Every time I'm on your show, I just start talking.
Yeah, at least this time I can elbow you if I need to.
Yeah, well, you haven't yet, so I'm too busy on Instagram.
I know. I'm posting photos of you.
Mm-hmm. Really was a cute photo, though, by the way. Just saying. I went with a comb-over today.
I saw that.
Yeah.
I think I like the spike better.
I like the spike, too. I mean, you gotta experiment, though. I haven't had hair in, like, 9 years,
You gotta go with it.
I texted a few friends at home, and I was like, comb-over or spike? And like, don't ever comb your hair over again.
I think it just needs to be longer.
And I was like, well, you took me to dinner last week, so I'm going to go with what you say. Because the food was good and I didn't pay for it. Yes, win. No more comb over. I will spike for free dinner. Call it a day.
Questions?
Questions.
One of the, to get kind of packed to the question at hand, and I think this is something that I don't have a lot of knowledge of, mainly because I'm male. But a lot of times, and this is maybe something I'm going to ask you to harp on, Sarah, is... a lot of times I run into females that are kind of going after that optimal leanness in their mind, you know, to fit the mold of a CrossFit female that they see on a
ballet dancer
or a ballet dancer or something like that. And I don't think a lot of women understand the associated risks that come along with being so lean and how truly unhealthy it is when it comes down to the point where, you know, you have a constant state of stress on your adrenals, you're losing your period, you have all these other side effects going down there just to achieve this optimal result that really doesn't define anything. It doesn't define performance or health at all. It's more of, a superficial
vanity.
Goal
yeah.
and vanity. So I think it would be important if you don't go science on Sarah on it, but just, you know, maybe mention a little bit of it and some of the other... I guess symptoms and signs that could cause some issues with that.
Yeah, well, I want to jump in because that was kind of what I was going to mention too, is that I really feel like Lauren could benefit from checking out Paleo for Women. We've actually had a whole podcast essentially around that topic before that Monica can link to, wherein, you know, we talk about the dangers and how hormone can affect the hormone dysregulation can negatively affect women's bodies, and that comes about from, you know, depriving yourself of things that your body thinks it needs. And if Lauren is truly eating a healthy, nutrient-rich diet that she feels satisfied and energized by, and she is, from what I'm seeing, 14 pounds above where she thinks she needs to be, that could be the 14 pounds of healthfulness that her body thinks that it needs for her to be healthy and fertile and sleep well and function and not be stressed and all the things that you talked about, Sarah, that mm-hmm. can come about from that extra weight loss. So I know that Stephanie from Paleo for Women has a ton of information on her site about this. And she herself, I think, has a background in dancing, which led to a lot of this kind of mentality, which then made her realize that she needed to eat more carbs and she needed to focus less on her body and more on health. And she looks amazing. Every time I see Stephanie, I think she's like some sort of ethereal goddess. But yeah, I just wanted to add my two cents in there.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean that she can't necessarily lose that weight and still be healthy, but sort of George's point of women wanting to be too thin, there are some real health risks associated with that. And the dominant one is interference with thyroid hormones and reproductive hormones. And it's because thyroid hormone, reproductive hormone, and stress hormone are all interconnected. So they all affect each other. And getting too lean is very, very stressful in the body. And actually being, you know, pushing the body routinely to excess, such as what elite athletes do. And I would put a professional dancer, I would probably put them in the same sort of category as an elite athlete, is actually been correlated with, a bunch of health issues, mostly caused by a weakened immune system. So that sort of frequent, really intense workouts with not enough rest period in between has been shown to weaken the immune system. One of the classic is that you see in elite athletes, like Olympic athletes, is a greater susceptibility to upper respiratory tract infections. And that comes from the suppression of the immune system that results from their training. So things to look at would be things that would be showing that hormone imbalances are occurring, like what George mentioned, loss of periods or period irregularity, signs of your thyroid not necessarily doing great things for you. So that would be things like fatigue, hair falling out, brittle nails, dry skin. And then things sort of that are showing that the body is really under a lot of stress. So that would be things like not sleeping well, not waking up rested, having to pee in the middle of the night. I usually sort of say once is probably normal for many people, but twice or three times or four times is definitely not normal. What else? Keeping weight around the middle is a classic sign of increased cortisol levels. And that might be exactly what she's dealing with now if she's worried about her weight. And so really there's sort of like this perfect balance when you're training. You know, being sedentary, as we already talked about, is correlated with bad health. It's not good for you. Having lots of mild to moderate activity in your life is really, really good for you and is correlated with all kinds of health benefits. And then being really excessively active is bad for you again. And the International Society for Exercise and Immunology calls this like the U-shaped relationship between physical activity and susceptibility to disease. So basically, there's this like perfect balance. And it's not a surprise. You know, when we talk about health and we talk about diet, it's always, you know, there's always this like normal range. You know, you want your you know, zinc or iodine levels or your, you know, vitamin A to be in a specific range and not enough, which is what we often talk about, is clearly a problem, but also too much is a problem. The body really wants everything to be in a pretty tight range, and that includes the things that we do to our body, like exercise, like training. So, so I don't know, George, is that, do you think I answered your question well enough there?
Yes, you went science first. Sorry. For sure. No, I think
that's what I do.
No, I think it's good. I mean, it just doesn't sound the same coming from a man. You know, I can sit here and spit it all day, but as someone that can't really experience it, only just from friends and people.
I think it's even more powerful coming from you. I think women need to hear that a man is not as interested in a woman being, you know, 15 pounds away from her goal weight as he is in her being healthy.
Yeah, no. That's not what I meant. I meant more talking along the lines of, like, the side effects of being lean. Like, yeah. A lot of people, I get it all the time. You know, we've had, obviously, podcasts about body image and stuff, but just because I look a certain way, I kind of get, you know, lumped into this group of people, or I'm assumed to be a certain way. But I'm definitely not tied to the amount of abs I have on my stomach, because I have to be honest with you that sometimes when I've had 8 of them or 6 of them, I do not feel good. Like, I just feel like crap. I walk around just exhausted. Doesn't matter if I'm eating carbs, doesn't matter what I'm doing. Like, being that lean just doesn't feel great to me. Like, I don't sleep as good and everything. So I keep myself above that point. And I mean, it feels better for me. So I really try and just get people to understand that you can't really tie health, you know, on a sliding scale to the way that your body looks. It can be a little bit both either way. And yes, I love women for being women, not for what they look like. I take a sense of humor and a smile any day. So that's my one cheesy comment.
Aww.
Yeah. Now you have even more women who love you.
Ugh, I know. And I just posted a picture on IG and got him in a bunch of trouble. So
you guys are killing me.
All right. Question number 2. You don't do it on purpose. That's why we, you know, like to squeeze you about it.
Do not squeeze me right now. I'm going to pop.
Oh, that's so sweet. That picture.
She just went on Instagram.
Aww.
Next question.
Right. I have a job to do. I forget. I was distracted by Instagram. Question number two.
Thank you for being distracted by my adoriableness, though. I really appreciate that.
It's only my kids
It's the George kids combination.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take that.
All right.
Another topic that was of popular demand by our listeners was pregnancy, breastfeeding, and first foods. And first up on our segment is episode 4, where Sarah shares some information on why breast milk is the perfect first food to grow your cave newborns.
So today on Science with Sarah, I thought it would be really interesting to go through the composition of breast milk and maybe explain for people who aren't familiar why it is such a perfect food for our babies. So breast milk really has 2 important functions. The first is to promote growth of the baby, and the second is immunologic, which means to protect the baby from infection. So breast milk is composed of, I mean, it's food, so it's composed of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. But what these have in common is they are simple, easy to digest. So the carbohydrates are mostly lactose, which is a disaccharide. It's just glucose and galactose. The fats are mostly very simple fats, triglycerides, cholesterol, short and medium chain polyunsaturated fats like DHA and ARA, which are very important for brain and nerve development. And the proteins tend to be very simple proteins like casein and albumin that don't take very much digestion to break it down to the essential amino acids that the baby can then use to live and grow. So in addition to sort of those basic macronutrients in breast milk, there's some really important extra components that typically have either the function of promoting growth and development of the baby or protecting the baby. So one of the things that is in breast milk is a variety of hormones. There are some hormones that will help promote digestion, help mature the digestive tract, that will help stimulate the baby's pancreas and gallbladder to release enzymes. There are several other hormones that are all growth hormones. And typically those growth hormones are, again, to help mature the digestive tract to get the baby ready for solid foods. There's also enzymes in breast milk. The enzymes kind of fall into two classes. There's digestive enzymes. So there's enzymes that break down sugars so that it can help break down that lactose into glucose and galactose, enzymes that help break down the protein, and enzymes that help break down the fat. So already in the breast milk is enzymes to help the baby's digestive system get a head start on breaking the milk down to its simplest components for absorption. And then there's also some enzymes that have immune modulating action, so that is part of protecting the baby. So they will help reduce inflammation or help good bacteria grow in the gut or help inhibit bad bacteria or, from growing in the gut of the baby. There's also probiotics in breast milk. So breast milk is actually the source of those good bacteria that are going to grow in the baby's digestive tract. There's antibodies in breast milk. And now those antibodies tend to be whatever antibodies the mom is making at that time. So it's really important because whatever germs are around you, the mom is being exposed to as well as the baby. The mom is making antibodies against those germs and passing those antibodies to the baby through her breast milk. So the baby's immune system for the first 4 months of life largely comes from directly from the breast milk. There's also white blood cells in breast milk, which are really special types of white blood cells that can tolerate the acidity of the stomach and the early intestine. They can tolerate high temperatures. They can tolerate bizarre changes in salinity. So they continue to live in the gut and help, again, sort of protect the baby from infection. And I guess the last thing is there's vitamins and minerals. So there's basically everything that your baby needs, not just in terms of nutrition to grow, but in terms of digestive support and immune system support for, ideal health. And those are not available in formula. So, so that is really it makes sense that our bodies are making the perfect food for our babies. And those are the things that make breast milk such a perfect food.
I think that's awesome. I think, when I talk about it in the communities that I'm in, I attend Low Leche League, and I haven't actually been going as frequently as I used to since Wesley weaned because it was a little bit emotionally painful for me. But the thing that the leaders kind of always say to people in a joking way when talking about nourishing themselves when breastfeeding is that the body will make the proper nutrients for baby regardless. So if you're not nourishing yourself as the breastfeeding mother, then you're depleting yourself of those vitamins and minerals and the things that has to be pulled from your body if you're not actually actively providing it yourself nutrients.
Yeah. My mom actually had a saying that was one baby, one tooth. And it actually comes from, not getting enough minerals in your own nutrition so that you end up being mineral deficient enough to have, tooth problems, tooth decay or cavities or whatever it might be, because your body prioritizes, except for in extreme famine situations, your body will always prioritize the baby's health over your own.
Yeah. And it's very common that women get sick, but their children don't get sick. And that they, like you said, get cavities and those kinds of things because they, if they're not focusing on their sleep habits and their nutrition, they themselves would get sick, but because their bodies are then turning around the, immunological benefits in the breast milk, the baby ends up not getting sick. So I personally, I guess we should have done a little bio about ourselves, but, you know, I breastfed all three of my boys for an average of about 18 to 22 months on each of them. And so for me, I can personally attest to the fact that my boys were rarely sick. Cole being the worst, he had some fever issues, but he never had ear infections or sinus infections or all the very common things that children get, colds and allergies and all that kind of stuff. I would get them, but he rarely had any problems, and Finn and Wes never had almost any. So I would wholeheartedly agree that not only does the science support it, but my anecdotal experience does as well.
Yeah, I guess I'll, you know, throw in that I breastfed both of my daughters until a few weeks after they each turned two, and it sort of just worked out that way. I weaned my oldest daughter because we were having a lot of issues with thrush, and we were on our third round of oral and topical antifungals, and we just kept passing it back and forth. And she was only nursing in the middle of the night. She wasn't nursing at any other time during the day. And it was so painful. And my breastfeeding relationship with her was painful most of the time because she had a tight frenulum. So she had a shallow latch at the same time as I had inverted nipples. So that meant that there was a lot of friction for the entire 2 years of nursing. And I used to get blisters, and I was just so stubborn that I was going to breastfeed this child until she weaned. And it was such a traumatic experience for me to wean her. It totally threw my hormone levels crazy off, so much so that I got pregnant 2 weeks later because I ovulated at the wrong time. And so then I had I had a much better, she had a much better latch. So it just made things so much easier. And she self-weaned at almost exactly the same age, and she just stopped one day. And I was heartbroken.
It's such a, you know, sweet sorrow feeling. Like, on one hand, you have your body back, and on the other hand, it's so sad. So
yeah.
You mentioned something about the short frenulum, and I really want to mention this because I've been hearing it from mothers a lot lately. The frenulum is kind of the web of the tongue underneath. It's like the flap of skin that connects the tongue to the mouth, and oftentimes people are born with that being, like you said, either really shallow or somewhat shallow to the point where it inhibits the nursing relationship. And the really great news is once you identify that that's an issue, it's a super simple clip of the tongue that can be done by pediatricians or whomever they refer you to. But I want to just mention this because one of the blogs that I enjoy reading is called Joyful Abode, and her second child was born with this issue, and she realized it at about 5 months, I believe. And she's been documenting rigorously the journey that they've been on to how they identified what the problem was and what they did to fix it, and her experience with all of that. And so although Sarah, you and I are no longer breastfeeding, I do have I have a series of posts on my blog called Baby Led Weaning, and I also have a two-part vlog, a video blog, where I talk about breastfeeding and I show holds and stuff like that. So people can find stuff in my blog, but it's not something that I'm doing anymore. So if you're listening to this and you're a breastfeeding mother, I would definitely recommend checking out Joyful Abode, who is she's actually tandem nursing her oldest daughter and her younger son. And it's a great blog to kind of keep up with if that's something that you're interested in right now.
Yeah, and I might just throw out a little bit of extra information for anybody who's dealing with flat or inverted nipples, because I was lucky enough to have a lactation consultant who was a very good lactation consultant come and visit me in the hospital when my oldest was born. And she gave me something called nipple shells, which is different than what many lactation consultants will give women with flat or inverted nipples. What many women are given are something called nipple shields. Now, the nipple shield is a plastic fake nipple that you put over top of your breast and the baby nurses through it. So there actually isn't direct skin-to-skin contact. The nipple shell, which is what I got, is actually like this cool plastic donut thing that goes on your nipple underneath your bra that you wear throughout the day, and it actually stretches out the ligaments on your nipple to correct the shape over time. So you can wear it for, I only wore it for 2 weeks with my second daughter. I think I wore it for 2 or 3 months with my first. And it actually will correct the inversion over time by stretching out those ligaments. And then you take it off to nurse so that you're actually have direct skin-to-skin contact. Some women can achieve something similar by pumping just a little bit to get their nipple to pop out before they latch on the baby, which is another strategy. But for any women who are having issues with latch because of flat or inverted nipples, I highly recommend finding nipple shells instead of nipple shields. And also, of course, that's a great argument for finding a really good lactation consultant or postpartum doula who can give you more constructive solutions for whatever your challenges are.
Absolutely. And I totally just learned something new, which I wasn't quite sure was possible with this topic. So thanks again.
Well, hey, I have this, you know, great background for learning things. Yeah. The hard way, typically.
Okay. Well, I won't bore you with my stories of oversupply and how that's obnoxious. So why don't we move on to questions and answer?
That's a great idea.
Next up by popular demand is episode 49, Paleo Philosophy Part 2. I think Sarah summed up this episode best when she said it was a very cathartic episode where her and Stacy connect on their feelings about the Weston A. Price article.
So you stopped to write a pretty epic post, though. Want to talk about that?
I did. I got a little sidetracked and wrote a rebuttal to an article that appeared in the most recent Weston A. Price Foundation newsletter that's called Wise Traditions. And the article was titled, I don't have it directly in front of me, so if I'm not exactly correct, I'm sure our listeners will forgive me. Myth, the Weston A. Price Foundation diet is like the paleo diet. And the article, it was actually you who sort of brought my attention to it in the first place.
My blood was boiling.
I know. That was clear. We didn't got everyone else's blood boiling. The article, it presents a critique of the paleo diet. And in its critique, it goes point by point through all of these things that it criticizes the paleo diet for as an example of how the Weston A. Price Foundation diet is different. Spoiler alert, the critique basically presents misinformation after misinformation after misinformation about what a paleo diet is.
Yes, if the paleo diet were that diet, there wouldn't be much in common.
No, that's very true. I think what really just got all of us going was that the last two paragraphs of this article critique parents who are raising children in a paleo lifestyle as being people who are constantly saying no to their kids and depriving their kids of, the modern culture of delicious food. And I took that quite personally because I really felt like it was a complete misrepresentation of what paleo families are trying to accomplish. It was insulting. It was divisive language when you're talking about something that is a diet that has an extraordinarily high amount of similarity to a paleo diet and root goals that are in common and a community where there's a lot of overlap between
the Weston A. Price Foundation community and the Paleo community. And so I wrote a very long post, and featuring a couple of quotes, one from yours truly. And I'm hoping that people will go and just have, I've really broken down their argument and, in my sort of signature, balanced, let's see what the science says kind of way, and pointed out that the real myth is that the one that they're trying to put forward, that the diets are completely dissimilar, which is absolutely not true. There's a huge amount of overlap between Weston A. Price Foundation and the Paleo diet. So I found the article really, well, it inspired me to write a monumental blog post.
I think, you know, it inspired a lot of us. At least there were several bloggers that were talking kind of behind the scenes once we saw the article. And I think we were all really upset. Like you said, we were personally insulted. And, you know, just for the sake of clarification, I did not take the time to write an epic post because you did that for me. And, you know, Diane said she was going to dedicate an entire podcast to her kind of ideas about it, which should be live right now.
It should be live by the time ours goes live. Like,
we haven't heard it, though, yesterday, because it's in a couple of days from now. But by the time this goes live, it should have been yesterday. So everybody should go check that out, because we're pretty sure that we're in alignment with what Diane's saying on that podcast, given the conversations that we've had. But I think overall, we just really felt frustrated by it. And there have been several instances where many of us bloggers have kind of reached out and tried to incorporate that community, because we feel very tightly aligned. We feel like we're both from an ancestral base. Sarah, I know you and I talk a lot about principles of Weston A. Price. We incorporate
bone broth, direct people to their websites all the time.
And we both believe, you know, that green pastures fermented cod liver oil is a great source of, you know, a supplemental food.
That's all the vitamins.
All this kind of stuff that we have in common. And it was really disappointing that where the paleo community is sharing with our community what we feel is really helpful and beneficial from the very smart people who are coming up with that in the Weston A. Price Foundation community, that the Weston A. Price Foundation community appears to be doing quite the opposite and creating a divisive role between us and saying, it is a myth that we are the same. Here's why it's not. Here's our condemning the thoughts of what is paleo, and really broke down in what felt judgmental and attacking, the things about paleo that they didn't like. And, you know,
while also, you know, putting forward a very, you know, false impression of what paleo is.
Right.
So if somebody's introduction to the idea of paleo was that, you know, newsletter article, they don't have any idea what a paleo diet is.
Right.
I mean, they're, you know, and which is what we've been talking about lately on the show.
Yes.
Is ties in really well with the topics we've talked about lately, about that sort of misinformation about what a paleo diet is based on some of the areas where the science isn't 100% clear. And so there's some differing opinions, and we've got some ongoing debate within the community.
Well, some of the items weren't even debatable, and some of them certainly weren't general consensus. And, you know,
in fact,
so I have two frustrations. One that we're talking about that I think Diana's covering and that you covered a bit in your post, where we're saying, I just think it's really uncool to be divisive like that. I don't think it's helping the community. I just don't. There are a lot of things that Matt and I could personally say about our own opinions on life, things that we personally believe in, but that because it's not to the benefit of the community, it's not applicable to that community, or it doesn't help the community grow, we choose to keep that to ourselves because it doesn't help anyone. And I think that there's, you know, I don't want to call myself mature, because there are certain things, there are certainly things that I do that are not mature at all. But I think that when you're a responsible individual that people listen to and look to, you have a responsibility to have a sense of maturity and one, research what you're talking about. And two, if you're going to talk about it, try to at least say, these are the things that we do have in common where we do agree on. And this is why so many of our community members are actually paleo dieting, paleo diet followers. This is why Weston A. Price Foundation conferences are populated with paleo people, including speakers. These are the things that we have in common where, you know, we totally agree, and some of their leaders, you know, also promote bone broth and organ meats, and, you know, go into some of the things that a lot of us are really putting out there and that we have in common, and then say where we differ is blah, blah, blah. You know, if that's what you want to take, then fine. But I just don't think it's responsible. I don't think it's good business, and I don't think it's good for the benefit of community, and with that means everybody's health, to be so picking at the myth of paleo and why everything's not the same. So that's my one soapbox, right? The one thing that really bothered me. The second thing is exactly what bothered you. That's where my quote came from. I was really insulted and really upset by saying that the paleo leaders, one, are all single and don't have children. Two.
Yeah. Keep going. Sorry.
Just from Canada. Yeah. Two, that those people who do have children are giving them some sort of social deficit and emotional disorders by not allowing them to eat junk food. And, you know, I think what infuriated me the most is, first of all, I wrote a book on how to incorporate a healthy lifestyle with children. We podcast almost every single week, and we say the words transition. We say do what works for your family. We say all these things. Chris Kresser, Rob Wolf, Mark Sisson. It's all 80-20. It's all figure out what works for you. Everybody has their own way that they say it, but every single leader in the community is saying, this is not going to be a sustainable lifestyle if you are perfect 100% of the time. And there is no way that anybody with a family could possibly attempt to, well, maybe you could. I don't think it would be healthy. I would agree with Weston A. Price to say that I don't think it would be healthy for an entire family to say, we are going to live our whole lives by these rules and we are never going to stray from them, no matter what the situation and no matter how it affects your body. Even if these foods are only, you know, mildly intolerable to you, don't even think about it. And if you don't, then, you know, you're punished. Like, if that's what a family did, probably there would be some, you know, rebellion in the later years when the children finally had access to foods, right? But for me, I have a child entering third grade who's 8 years old, and he pretty much makes his own choices at this point. When we go out to eat, he chooses to get a bunless burger and his splurge is dairy. Like, he chooses to get grass-fed butter at grass-fed cheese at Elevation Burger because that's like his big splurge. Honestly, that's what I have raised my child to do, to go to a restaurant and to order a bunless grass-fed burger with grass-fed cheese, pickles, mushrooms, and lettuce. He's really deprived and he's really miserable that he's happily ordering this food that nourishes his body and makes him happy, makes him feel socially normal that he just ordered something at a restaurant himself that he likes. Heaven forbid he not have a bun on his burger. Okay, that's the first part. The second part is, if the argument is that paleo kids are so deprived, what part of a Weston A. Price Foundation diet isn't also depriving these children?
Because no kidding.
Yeah. From everything that I've read about Weston A. Price, if you have to sprout your grains, if you have to eat high-quality, grass-fed, and raw dairy, where are you finding that in the schools? Because I'll tell you, the schools that I go to, they're giving pixie sticks in math class. They're giving Skittles for English lessons. So that's no more Weston A. Price approved than anything else. If my child chooses to eat a grain-free cookie instead of the pixie sticks, wouldn't a Weston A. Price child have to do the same? It didn't even make sense to me. And it was so infuriating that, like you said, Sarah, someone who didn't know anything about the paleo diet would be exposed to this article and would just, in my opinion, completely dismiss us
as a bunch of
extremist crackpots or something. And I just, it was really infuriating and upsetting because I just don't feel like it helps other people, which is disappointing. To me, I feel like my mission, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to sacrifice the time that I spend with my family, the time that I have that I want to be doing other things, if I'm going to commit to this blog, it is because I want to help other people. And I just didn't feel like that article was helping anybody.
Well, and given that we have so much in common in terms of a focus on nutrient density, a focus on supporting digestion, a focus on eating snout to tail and eating variety and eating local and organic and high quality and grass fed. I mean, we have all of these things in common, and you would think that we could combine our resources to help educate, and you could educate people in the, you know, well, you know, this is all the stuff we have in common. A paleo diet, you know, avoids grains and legumes, whereas a Weston A. Price Foundation diet incorporates them when they're traditionally prepared. You know, to me, that's a small difference when you look at everything that is in common. And, you know, I think that you could reach so many more people by pooling our influence and pooling our resources and working together for, you know, the greater good of, you know, the nutrient density of the American diet. And instead, you know, they just seem to really want to separate themselves from the paleo movement. And I don't understand where that would come from, if that comes from just a misunderstanding of what the paleo diet is and what this community is about, or if it comes from some kind of ulterior motive, some kind of marketing strategy. I mean, I don't know, because it's so beyond my ability to fathom why somebody would reject the opportunity to help more people because they don't want, you know, to collaborate with a particular community that has so much in common. Like, it just, to me, it doesn't make sense. And I'm sure at some point the real story will come out and we'll find out what this is all really about. But it was, I just found like this, the whole not hinting out, like outright saying, and I actually quote the relevant paragraph in my post, that, you know, if you were a Weston A. Price Foundation diet, you would be, you know, allowing your children to experience, you know, grains and dairy, because we have this grain and dairy centered culture, by giving them sourdough bread that you've made yourself and you've fermented the grains yourself, and by giving them homemade ice cream. So my almond flour bread and my homemade coconut milk ice cream are somehow not, you know, providing the same, you know, emotional, you know, fun, fitting in, you know, the thing that theirs is. Like, it's
never mind the health benefits that our children have seen by removing casein from their diet. Like,
well, my youngest is extraordinarily sensitive to casein, like crazy sensitive, and has really, like, you know, thinking about dialing 911 type reactions to it. And you know, it's a toxin for her. And, you know, my oldest, she tolerates it from time to time, and it's fine. And she can have dairy for a treat. And, you know, I just don't keep it in the house, because literally a few days ago, my youngest ate a bite of food that touched a piece of Parmesan cheese. I took the Parmesan off, and she had obstructive sleep apnea from acid reflux caused by her dairy intolerance because of that. Like, she can't have ghee because of the trace proteins. And it just, it infuriates me that my trying to find a way to raise my children in a healthy way where they don't feel like they're different or missing out on something. Like, I work really hard to make them feel included in their community and their society, even though they eat differently than most of their peers. And they eat differently. You know, really, my kids have really, really legitimate sensitivities to these foods. And it just, I don't even know if I mean, I guess I sort of got all my my expressions out in my blog post. It's really hard for me to explain how personal that statement was and how that just was like getting punched in the stomach. Like it was, you know, it was so insulting to be told that basically I'm a bad parent because I care about the nutrient density of my children's diets and that I care that, that they are eating the best possible, foods and choices, you know, for them, that works for them, that finds that balance for them between nourishing their bodies and also, you know, allowing them to be kids and fit in. Like I know you felt the same. But it just, it was a very, as we've already said, it was a very divisive, article, and I don't know where it came from, but I wrote a very substantial blog post in rebuttal to it.
I completely agree with everything you just said, and I also want people to understand that this is not the first time that the paleo community has experienced this attitude from Weston A. Price. It's just the first time that it's been so public and so clearly explained and shared with the community that we felt like we needed to respond back because it wasn't okay just left as it was. So, you know, if people are like, oh, well, maybe one person wrote this article and it wasn't, you know, edited properly and it's just, you know, one person's perception that accidentally got shared, I can tell you that that is absolutely not the case, that there are very many of us that have communicated with one another and I've all had individual experiences similar to this sort of divisive attitude and, you know, some sort of preconceived notion of what paleo is without wanting any sort of further discussion or explanation on that. And so I just want people to know that we're not just taking like one thing and running with it and assuming the worst. This is definitely something that we've seen and experienced multiple times through, you know, being leaders in the movement and the community and kind of having interactions with one another and kind of, you know, walking away dumbfounded, not knowing really quite what just happened or what to do about it. And finally something happened that sparked us all enough to to get our panties in a wad.
That wraps up our show of favorite episodes from the past year. If you enjoy all that you've been learning from the Paleo View, please make sure to leave a review and tell us why you love the show and how it's been impacting your life and your paleo journey. And thanks again for listening to me. Stacey and Sarah will be back next week with Amy to discuss blood sugar regulation.
Thank you for listening to the Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I just totally lost my train of thought. Excellent. And I only had one Anchorman moment. That's so good. You stay classy, Paleo View.